This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Thank you for joining us on this new episode of Trumpet Hour. This is our first Week in Review episode of 2017, and our panel of trumpet writers are all anxious to tell you about the biggest news stories that happened during the first week of this year. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
And Anthony Chibadirwe.
Good to be here.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, Israel, we have Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Well, 2017 marks the 50th anniversary of the pivotal Six-Day War in the Middle East. That was when the tiny Jewish state of Israel defended itself against several Arab armies simultaneously. And Israel not only survived that war, but came out on the other side of it possessing significantly more territory than before. They won the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt, the Golan Heights from Syria, and the West Bank from Jordan. Probably the most emotional and important part of that war happened on day two of the war when the Israeli army chaplain assembled many people before the Western Wall and he blew the shofar there. That solemn blast announced to the world that the Jews had captured the Old City and the Temple Mount. So for the first time in almost 2,000 years, Jerusalem was united under Jewish rule. But now here we are 50 years on, and we have to ask, will United Jerusalem make it to year 51? Brent Noctegal, our man in Jerusalem, has written the cover story for the Trumpet Weekly this week about this. Brent, what do you think? Is this the year that that victory will be undone?
I don't know if it's definitely the year that it's going to happen, but the situation that we have coming into 2017 makes it extremely ripe for happening. We don't want to sound down on Israel at all or wanting this to happen, but there is a clear Bible prophecy that does indicate that half of Jerusalem is going to fall out of Israeli hands. It's found in the book of Zechariah. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has mentioned this a lot because it really does start a chain reaction of events, prophetic events that take place that lead up to the critical return of Jesus Christ and the most important event in the history of man to this point. So it's something that we're really watching for half of Jerusalem to fall out of Israeli hands. And as we go into 2017, there is more talk about Jerusalem's status than there has been for a number of years. It's the 50th anniversary, this 2017, of the Six-Day War. So it's the 50th anniversary of them, of the Jews taking the holiest site in Judaism, the Temple Mount, the Western Wailing Wall. In June this year, there's going to be a number of huge celebrations in Jerusalem celebrating that. And yet, what did we have in December but the United Nations Security Council with United States backing, or at least failing to veto this resolution, really putting Jerusalem on the chopping block before the world, and saying that already Jerusalem, well, half of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, does not belong to the Jews. In fact, if Jews live there, they are occupiers. They are breaking international law as they see it. It's invalid, the Israeli occupation of East Jerusalem. And they have really brought the world's attention to Jerusalem's status through the Security Council resolution.
I've heard some speculation that U.S. President Barack Obama might surprise the world in the final days of his presidency by officially recognizing a state of Palestine, possibly with East Jerusalem as the capital. What do you think about that? Could you foresee something like that happening?
It's possible that might happen. I mean, I feel like the damage is done enough with this resolution, actually. But, you know, there have been rumors. Carolyn Glick, one of the great columnists here for Jerusalem Post, she's discussed that in a column a week ago. Prime Minister Netanyahu had a Knesset meeting last week with his cabinet, and he discussed the likelihood that America was planning something else before President Obama left office that could could result in, you know, a declaration of a Palestinian state by the United States. We'll see.
Okay, so you said the damage has possibly already been done just with this United Nations resolution. Was that just because of the United States support for it, or was this something, you know, something that we've not really seen before with this type of resolution?
Well, it's a bit of both, because this resolution obviously wouldn't have passed if the United States had kept to its historic position of vetoing anti-Israel resolutions at the Security Council. But this resolution goes into far greater specificity about what it is after. It doesn't just talk about Israeli settlements in the West Bank, the area that they conquered from Jordan, Judea, and Samaria during the Six-Day War. It specifically calls out East Jerusalem as being part of Israel's illegal territorial holdings. The first three clauses of it says this: the United Nations Security Council reaffirms that the establishment of Israel by Israel of settlements in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967, including East Jerusalem, has no legal validity and is a violation. Then the next clause talks about them, that they need to cease all settlement activity in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem. They are just very specific about this, that East Jerusalem is not, well, Jerusalem itself is not up for negotiation anymore, according to the United Nations. It was always the case that Jerusalem, in any final peace deal with the Palestinians and Israelis, that Jerusalem was a totally separate deal. That, yes, they would probably get the West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinians. But when it came to Jerusalem, it wasn't a done deal that they were going to get East Jerusalem. We were going to try and figure out some power sharing maybe inside Jerusalem, but we weren't sure. But now the UN has said no. The negotiating position from this point forward is East Jerusalem already belongs to the Palestinians. That's the world's point of view, and now America shares that point of view. Now, we could say, well, who cares about what the UN thinks? And, you know, that is, you know, definitely what Mr. Trump would say. Who cares what the UN says? They don't have the power to do anything. Well, they don't right now, but the big question is whether the Palestinians themselves will act on this resolution. And I think that's what we might see in 2017, is that the Palestinians, having received backing and international legitimacy by the foremost world body, the closest thing we have to a world government, has said that that's land is yours. It's not Israel's. So why don't you go take it? If they start taking it, it's going to put the world in a difficult position of whether they will support the Palestinian cause more forcefully. And all of those things that I'm discussing are backed up by biblical prophecies of things that are actually going to take place in the near future. So this is something that we should be concerned about.
Sounds like that could really embolden the Palestinian cause there. Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. Well, in 2 weeks from today, actually, Mr. Donald J. Trump will become the president of the United States. And Mr. Trump has pledged to shake off burdens placed on the U.S. by multilateral institutions and by various U.S. allies. He said that he'll use his presidential powers to pressure key economic actors. From the sounds of things, he is going to be leading the world's most powerful country in quite a different direction than that of a lot of his predecessors. And countries around the world are already trying to brace themselves and to reposition themselves for those changes. Some nations seem to be embracing Mr. Trump. The Russian leadership, for example, they've said that they expect relations between Russia and the U.S. to improve under Mr. Trump. But many other countries are worried, and they're planning a path forward for themselves that is not dependent on America. One of the major players in the second category is Germany. Germany seems to be bracing itself for a split with America, which could really shake the pillars of the whole post-war order. To tell us about this development, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is really something we've been talking about right from Donald Trump's election, what effect this is going to have on Germany and the potential for a split with Europe. But this week, just a couple of days ago, Spiegel Online published an article where they drew upon some more private conversations, some anonymous comments from senior German diplomats, this kind of thing, that just give us a more detailed picture of what Germany is thinking about Donald Trump's presidency and how they're planning on responding. So one point that came out from this, for example, is that Angela Merkel had a telephone conversation with Donald Trump on November 11th, where we've commented before on her conditional support for Donald Trump, that conditional congratulations that she offered after the election, where she said, well, contingent on America supporting this value, this value, and this value, we support Donald Trump. Well, apparently she elaborated more on this on the phone conversation, and this phone conversation left Donald Trump, in the words of the Spiegel, thoroughly unimpressed. The article also drew attention to the change in tone from Angela Merkel. She said at a party conference, many have the feeling that the world has been turned upside down. They quoted a high-ranking German diplomat saying, we have to brace for difficult years in transatlantic relations. And they kind of it talks about how this really did begin under President Obama, and that this kind of shift, his shift to the Pacific, as he called it, that just really ended up being a disengagement from Europe, is something that they're now just seeing going to accelerate. And then, of course, these worries about NATO. So those are kind of some of the new revelations that this brought out. And then one other aspect of the Spiegel article that I thought was just really interesting was its conclusion. And it ended up by talking about this push that we've been talking about quite a lot on this program for a European army. They quoted Angela Merkel saying that within only a few months, a considerable amount of cooperation has taken place, about how Merkel and her colleagues agreed to transfer a bit of sovereignty in defense matters that they had spent decades guarding zealously. And then their final couple of sentences, if Europe were to close rank, then Trump's election would have at least one positive effect. During his time as Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger once famously quipped, who do I call if I want to speak to Europe? It is possible that the EU may soon finally have such a number, thanks to Donald Trump.
Wow. Well, what do you think a Germany divorced from America would look like?
Well, I think this is going to be one of the big questions of the next year. I gave a Trumpet Daily Radio program yesterday where I elaborated on this a bit more. We don't know everything Donald Trump is going to do. I still think we really don't know what his Russia policy is going to look like. I think things are looking like they could be quite friendly. But if you look at what things, for example, that Mike Pence have said about Russia, he is considerably more Putin skeptic, if I could put it that way. And Donald Trump has also said that he intends to give his vice president considerable latitude, especially on foreign policy. So I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that he's going to be very much pro-Russia. But if he is, well, this puts Germany into a very interesting position. For decades, their entire foreign policy has basically been to stand in America's shadow. They have obviously done things for their own ends on the world scene, but they never really wanted to obviously lead and obviously throw their weight around. Now, with Donald Trump's election, that makes that much harder. And we already saw that with Angela Merkel and those conditional messages of support that she gave for Donald Trump. Germany is having to step out of that shadow now. And that will be especially so if Donald Trump does warm up to Russia. And the New York Times had an article this week talking about, well, if that happens, Vladimir Putin likes to have a bogeyman. He likes to have somebody that he can blame as the cause of all of Russia's troubles. And that's been President Obama thus far. And under Donald Trump, the American president may not be that bogeyman anymore. And this article is making the point, well, the best candidate for that is the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, instead being kind of Russia's chief bogeyman. So there's another interesting scenario that would really put a lot of pressure on German foreign policy, force Germany to lead. So I think the result of this presidency is just going to be a lot more pressure on Germany to really act, to lead, and it'll just be forced to make their own decisions and even just throw its weight around in order to protect its own interests on the world scene in a way that it hasn't had to, because America's been there generally protecting German interests before.
Well, thank you for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Well, Germany is not the only country that seems to have sort of a wary eye on America. The North Korean leader brought in the new year on Sunday by proclaiming that he would soon test a new missile powerful enough to give North Korea, for the very first time, the ability to hit America's west coast with nuclear warheads. To tell us about this proclamation and some of the reactions to it, we'll turn to Anthony.
Yeah, let's just begin by re-emphasizing the significance of the timing of this announcement. Like you said, the start of the new year came up with something new, and that was the warning that came from North Korea. Kim Jong-un announced to the whole world on January 1st that his nation had reached the final stage in preparations to test launch a K-908 intercontinental ballistic missile. Now, this is significant, and you can see why Kim would want to announce this in such epic fashion. I'm sure a lot of our readers, they know that North Korea, whenever it's in the news, there's something to do with test firing projectiles and bombs. But then this is not just same old, because the North Korea, if it's successful in launching this K-908 missile, it would be the first ever long-range ICBM launch. Now, in the past, the North has test-fired short-range missiles, medium-range missiles, but this missile could potentially reach the worst cost of the United States, and that test would be a violation of international law, and it could pose a significant nuclear threat to the United States. So the big question now is, how big of a threat is it? How serious of a threat is it? Now, as you said in the introduction there, President-elect Donald Trump responded to North Korea's statement with a tweet, and this is what he said. North Korea just stated that it is in the final stages of developing a nuclear weapon capable of reaching parts of the U.S. It won't happen. That was the tweet, and I remember when I listened to it on radio, and my initial reaction to that tweet was, those are pretty strong statements.
Yeah, it sounds nice, like a red strong line, really.
Firm. Yeah, and I'm sure also I felt like, you know, when a nation is facing such threats, it's always nice to have someone who has some reassuring words, and that's what Mr. Trump said. But the big question is, how much substance is in those words? You know, it wasn't even clear whether Mr. Trump was saying that the test itself won't happen, or if he meant that the North reaching the U.S. with a nuclear weapon won't happen. But whatever he meant, the threat posed by North Korea is not as simple as Mr. Trump makes it out to be. If the president-elect meant that the test itself won't happen, well, he could be proven wrong in the next few months, because North Korea has repeatedly defied the United States and the international community in its drive to develop nuclear weapons and missile programs. And it has repeatedly violated a lot of those resolutions, you know, one after the other. And preventing another test is going to be just a lot more difficult without a preemptive strike from the U.S. or anyone else. So, yeah, Mr. Trump could be proven wrong.
Yeah, that's true. If he was saying it won't happen, meaning a missile reaching the West Coast, I believe he's right about that. We have incredible missile defense systems, especially up against North Korean weaponry, which is still very primitive compared to what America would have. But if he's saying the test won't happen, that would be quite difficult to, you know, go inside of North Korea and prevent them from conducting a test deep inside one of their bunkers or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, despite how impoverished North Korea is, it has proven capable of, you know, producing quite some impressive technology, military technology. An expert at the East Asia Non-Proliferation Program told CNN on Tuesday that this test will probably happen this year, no matter what Trump tweets. Most people in the world, especially in the West, they're just going to look at Trump's tweet as a red line that's not much different from President Obama's red line statement with Syria, where he makes a strong statement and then he backs away from it. But if this happens, if Mr. Trump doesn't prevent this test, that could cause serious problems. That could even embolden the North, just like Mr. Obama's statements is essentially embolden Assad in Syria.
Richard, did you have a comment on this?
Yeah, well, a question more for Anthony. But in the past, when we've talked about North Korea, and I think Mr. McDonald wrote an article on this a few years ago, we've kind of said, well, look, the only way you're ever going to control North Korea is to stand up to their backers, China. You know, China's been enabling this. They've done a whole number of different... They've refused to clamp down on North Korea and support sanctions and all this kind of thing. If we want to stop North Korea doing this, we need to confront China. Now, Donald Trump, it sounds like he is going to confront China. So if he is, at least appears to be following some of our advice in a way on that, do you think he could have some success here?
That's a good point. Yes, he sounds like he's going to confront China, and that is a good thing. Following his tweet, he followed up his tweet with another message just saying that China is not doing enough to stop North Korea. And that is right. Like you said, North Korea has been receiving a lot of backing, financial backing and other sorts of support from China. And Trump recognizes this. And he sent a message just mentioning that and telling China that he needs to do more about it. I guess the question remains, how much will those words translate to action? Considering that this has been happening, this has been ongoing for years and years and years, it takes a lot to convert those words into solid action that puts a permanent stop to what North Korea has been doing all these past years.
Thanks very much for that, Anthony. We've just spoken about Mr. Trump coming into power, replacing President Barack Obama, and what that may mean for nations like Germany and North Korea. But reports this week say that just because Mr. Obama is leaving the presidency, that doesn't mean he'll be spending the rest of his days sipping piña coladas on a beach somewhere and working on his golf handicap. These reports say that it is clear that Mr. Obama will use his influence to keep on pushing his agenda and keep on working to accomplish his radical vision for the United States. For this story, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Right, we are definitely starting to see what the post-presidency of Barack Obama is going to look like. He has been one of our youngest presidents in U.S. history, so most people expected that he would want to do something else after leaving office. And for months, there have been some rumors about being the head of the United Nations, which didn't really pan out, or some rumors of him starting his own media company, which he's since denied. But he has he's purchased a house in the Washington, D.C. area. He's rented some office space at the World Wildlife Fund building, not necessarily working for that organization, but they were renting office space. And especially after the election, he'd given a speech just reassuring Democrats that next year both Michelle and him are going to be right there with you. They're going to be busy. They're going to be involved in some amazing stuff that they're going to be doing over these next few years. So it definitely looks like he's not going to be a George W. Bush style post-president where you just kind of leave office and you don't hear much from him. He definitely looks like he's going more for like the Jimmy Carter style of post-presidency, where he'll inject himself into the conflict between Israel and Hamas, whether the U.S. government wants his help or not.
So this makes me wonder how much power Mr. Obama would really have after he leaves office. I mean, will he really be in a position to strengthen these somewhat radical movements that still seem fairly small even after 8 years of his presidency?
Right. Well, definitely wouldn't have any official government power have leaving office, but he was trained primarily as a community organizer, and that is the two things he said he really wants to focus on. Is one, he wants to focus on the Democratic Party effort to redistrict some of the congressional zones. He's saying that the way the lines are drawn gives the Republicans too much influence. So if you can redraw some of those lines to try to tip power back towards the Democratic Party, that's something he wants to be involved with. He definitely wants to be involved with, by his own admission, the training the next generation of Democratic Party leaders. He's written, just this week, he's written a piece on criminal justice reform for the Harvard Law Review, where he's been actually really, he was really bold talking about how the next president really needs to try to get our incarceration rate down, and even making the comparison that the number of blacks in prison is like the modern day version of slavery in wow. America. So that's something that as president, you have to be careful when you say things like that, because you might not win your next election, or you might get some pushback from Congress on a bill that you want passed. As ex-president, you can get away with some things like that. So that is, in some ways, and I've definitely heard this before, that they said as far as just like community organizing or really stirring up groups of people, he could even be more effective at that particular task as an ex-president, because he doesn't have the restraints on some of the more radical viewpoints that he definitely expressed before he was president, and now and then had to tone back on a little bit during his presidency, and is now getting ready to talk to again.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. Sounds like something really vital for us to keep a close eye on there. You're listening to The Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. And the live stream is available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we're going to talk about Russia and Turkey potentially sidelining Iran out of the Syrian conflict, the increasing power of Bavaria, the Philippines' ongoing shift from America toward Russia and China. And we're also going to talk about what a Trump-Putin alliance that many expect could mean for the world. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. One development that Trumpet Hour and really almost all media have been carefully monitoring is the war in Syria. When Russia entered into that conflict last summer, it really caught many of us off guard, and it also began to really drastically shift the tides in favor of the Syrian regime, which both Russia and Iran were supporting. In the months since then, Russia and Iran have worked together on many offensives in that conflict, and Iran was benefiting quite a lot from Russia's presence. But now, somewhat suddenly, it looks like Iran is being sidelined and pushed back in Syria by both Russia and Turkey. This is a pretty significant development. To tell us about what's going on there, we'll go once again to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so it is. This is something that is just starting to be noticeable of late, especially after the besiegement of Aleppo and the fall of Aleppo in the latter part of December, the last stronghold of the rebels. And Iran and Russia were fighting together in tandem, Iran using its proxies plus its own IRGC forces on the ground there, and Russia supplying the air bombardments on Aleppo. And it seems like after that point, after the city was taken, Russia has really tried hard to push towards a negotiated peace settlement with both the Bashar al-Assad, the ruler of Syria, and with Turkey. Turkey is the nation that represents the rebels at the negotiating table. And it seems that Iran is the one nation that is kind of getting left out in the cold as far as its objectives from or inside Syria, why it's there in the first place. Now, again, you're not going to read too much about this. There's a number of writers that are putting out their stories. A lot of them are op-eds, are noticing that Iran is kind of being sidelined by Russia. So this is still in its early stages right now. But it's interesting for us to see that, because we have talked a lot about Iran falling out of favor with the Syrian regime, with that alliance being shattered through the Syrian civil war. We didn't really know how that was going to come about. Yet it looks like Russia might be the intermediary here, or the power that brings this change to Syria's alignment about because of its involvement there.
You mentioned that this is very much in the early phases, and you know, not really visible in some ways at this point. What do you think is the time frame that we could expect for this to be a clear, more visible trend?
It's hard to give a time frame for it, but I would say that things are moving ahead with it every week. I mean, just this past week, we had something really interesting happen. We had the Turkish military offensive coming down from northern Turkey into Syria to fight against the Islamic State. And normally, Turkey and Russia have been at opposite end of the spectrum. One, Turkey wants Assad to leave and the Syrian regime to change. And Russia was supporting Iran and upholding the Syrian regime. But what happened this week is that the Russian bombers actually helped out a Turkish offensive against the Islamic State. This hasn't happened. A year ago, the Turks were firing on Russian jets over their airspace and actually took down one of their fighters. Yet we have Turkey and Russia aligning closer in northern Syria in the fight against the Islamic State. And it seems that it's coming at the expense of Iran. Now, this is an interesting development, because back in June 2015, it was Iran that, you know, sent their commander, Qassem Soleimani, the head of their Quds force, up to Moscow to talk with Putin and ask for assistance in this fight. Their back was against the wall, helping out Assad against these rebels, and they needed Moscow's assistance. So Moscow says, yes, we'll come down and help you, and they have. And yet, once it looks like the Syrian regime will prevail, Moscow has its interests that are divergent from Iran's interests in Syria, and that seems to be playing out now.
Could you talk a little bit about the Bible prophecies that inform our view of this, and the passages that prompt us to expect that Iran will sort of lose influence in Syria?
Right. It gets back to the two alliances that we see developing in the Middle East, and Bible prophecy does foretell them, and they are aligning in dramatic detail. One of those are the alliance of the King of the South. This is the headed by Iran and nations that are allied to them. And we know that Iraq is going to be a part of that alliance. Egypt is going to be a part of that alliance as well, definitely. Libya, Ethiopia, those nations will be part of that alliance. But one nation that is not going to be a part of that alliance is Syria. Syria belongs to another Middle Eastern end time alliance known as the Psalm 83 Alliance. Well, that's what we call it because it's found in Psalm 83. And the nation, the ancient nation that looks to have inhabited the Syrian region, was known as the Hagarenes, at least part of the Syrian state today. These borders that we have today, they are modern constructs, so it doesn't follow exactly the modern borders. Yet inside the territory of Syria, we have the group known as the Hagarenes, and they are aligned with more of the Sunni Arab states, such as Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Jordan. So we have expected for years now Syria to fall out of favor, with Iran to flip-flop over to the other Arab alliance.
Thank you, Brent. We'll turn next once again to Germany. In the first half of the show, we talked about concerns among the German leadership about U.S. President-elect Donald Trump and how those concerns might drastically change the direction of the German leadership. But a big part of this equation is who the German leadership will be. Will Angela Merkel be the chancellor who deals with Mr. Trump? Or will she be defeated in elections next year and be replaced by another leader? If so, who might that other leader be? What party might he or she belong to? There's all kinds of speculation about these questions, and there's a lot that we can't yet know. But an analysis this week says that if we want to have a good idea of what changes are in store for the German leadership, we have to be watching what's happening in Germany's southern power, the state of Bavaria. To hear about this, we'll turn once again to Richard.
That's right. In this week's Trumpet Weekly, we have what I think is some excerpts from a fascinating article from Foreign Policy. And if anyone is interested in German politics, I'd certainly recommend clicking through to the link and reading that full piece on Foreign Policy's website. But they make the case that, similar to what we've made, well, yes, okay, the alternative for Deutschland, it's a very important trend in Germany. It's a symptom of a major change within German society, big developments, a lot of dissatisfaction, etc. But the alternative for Deutschland is not going to gain a majority in the German parliament. We're not going to see an alternative for Deutschland chancellor at the end of the next election. And what this article says is, in other words, anyone who wants to stand the political fight that looms in Germany's immediate future should spend less time studying the populist Alternative for Germany party and then the entrenched political establishment of the southern German state of Bavaria. And this article then went on to goes into just the last 200 years of history of rivalry between southern Bavaria and northern Prussia. And it really reminded me of an article our own Josué Michels had up on our website about 6 months ago or so about the Bavarian Lion. If you search on that, that should pull that article up. And just going into some of the history here of the influence Bavaria has had within Germany. And this article was just really making the case that the migrant crisis and the split in the migrant crisis within Germany just adds to this much older rivalry for power within Germany and who would lead Germany, the Prussian north with its capital in Berlin or Munich and Bavaria in the south. And of course, this historic split is reflected politically. They're sister parties, but Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union runs everywhere else in Bavaria. And then it's allied with the Christian Social Union, which runs only in Bavaria. And so this article makes the case, well, if you want to see the future of Germany, look to the Christian Social Union in Bavaria. And this article concludes that if Merkel and liberal democratic policy she upholds fades from the scenes, Germans could wake up one fine morning to find themselves governed by a far more folksy and potentially far more conservative chancellor decked out in Lederhosen, that outfit that is especially associated with Bavaria. And this is exactly the same point we've been making at the Trumpet for years. You know, all the people that we've pointed to as potential strongmen, as potential men fulfilling that Daniel 8 prophecy in about a strong leader arising in Germany, they've all been Bavarians. Mr. Armstrong pointed to Franz Josef Strauss, and then we pointed to his mentor, Edmund Stoiber, as a possibility. And then more recently, a man that Stoiber really played a strong role in training, Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg. And they're all Bavarians. They're all from this Christian Social Union. So I think it's a fascinating article to have come out at the start of 2017 and just shows the importance of watching Bavaria and watching this Christian Social Union and how that develops in German politics over the next year or so.
How soon do you think we could expect any specific Bavarians or possibly a group of them or the CSU in general to really begin to take on greater powers?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I would say that, in my opinion, the most probable way this could play out would be to see Ms. Merkel maybe do well in win the election, have enough seats to still be a large party and perhaps cobble together a coalition, but at the same time to still be wounded enough by the rise of the Alternative for Deutschland that it's kind of a Pyrrhic victory or a victory that's not as big as everyone is just kind of expecting her, not as easy as the kind of the cakewalk that a lot of people expect. And just the fact that she wasn't able to command the same kind of victory that she has in the past to begin a search for new German leadership, and then for the Christian Social Union to kind of come to the fore within that. Now, that's just one possible scenario of a great many. Elections always throw up a lot of uncertainty, especially over the next year or so. But that's one way that could happen.
Yeah, it is interesting. I know Franz Josef Strauss always used to have like a political maxim he used that he said, never let I'll never let my party be challenged by an electoral and an electorally viable party from the right. It basically means let no major party get to the right of you. We always run elections against parties from the left. So any time that would happen, he'd shift his party a little further right and kind of cut them off at the pass. Seems like Horst Seehofer has really kind of taken that advice more than Angela Merkel has. And as this Alternative for Deutschland's rising, he's moving the Christian Social Union to a more anti-immigrant stance, so they can't get over to that share of the electorate around him, and has really gained quite a bit of like political currency that way.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I think what the interesting thing with that is, Germany's never been challenged with such a large vote for a right-wing party as they have for the Alternative for Deutschland, not in post-war Europe. And so it's really pushing, I think, the Christian Social Union are being forced to take a far more turn more to the right than they have in the past. So it's a very clear and concrete way that the Alternative for Deutschland is impacting German politics, even though, as you said, they're not going to, say, be the top party in the election. They're certainly having a huge impact.
Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. For this next story, we'll take a look at the Philippines, which has long been a pillar of America's power and influence in Asia. For more than half a century, the Philippines has relied heavily on the United States and also really helped America to ensure that that region remains stable to a degree. But now, all of that seems like it could very quickly change. For this, we'll go back to Anthony.
Russia is ready to become a new reliable partner and close friend of the Philippines. Now, that was a statement made by Russia's ambassador to the Philippines on Wednesday. And just the day before that statement, two Russian warships had been sent to the Philippines. And it was an anti-submarine craft and an ocean tanker. And this was the first such Navy-to-Navy contact between the two nations. And the Russians said that this was a goodwill visit that will last 4 days. The Russians will be demonstrating their anti-terrorism capabilities, and they'll hold discussions about the possibility of joint maritime drills with the Philippines. So this is a pretty huge development. The Russian ambassador said that they plan to provide the Philippines with advanced weaponry, including submarines and aircraft. So this is a pretty significant development, but, you know, Russia was very quick to say, hey, don't worry about it. They made an announcement just saying, hey, your traditional partners talking to the Philippines. It said your traditional partners should not be concerned about what we're doing about these military ties. But the Philippines' traditional partners ought to be worried about what's happening, because it is a pretty significant development. Many analysts talk about this. There was, in our Trump Weekly, we have a piece about it, and there's a report from the AFP that talks about this development and says that this is a strategic shift away from the U.S. If the Philippines is making this strategic shift away from the U.S. and toward Asian partners.
And it's also happening to a degree with China, isn't it? It's not just Russia.
Exactly. And China is a very good case study for this development. The piece from the AFP talks about this as a strategic shift in foreign policy. In fact, it quotes the Philippines ambassador to China saying that. And he also added this. He said that we were one-sidedly imbalanced in favor of the U.S., even though he reassured that the Philippines is not abandoning the alliance with the U.S., he's saying that we were imbalanced. Now, you know, the U.S. is so intricately involved in a lot of nations in the world. It's not going to just automatically cut off those ties completely. But this is significant. The United, like you said, like this ambassador said, we are not abandoning our alliance with the U.S. Yes, it may never be completely cut off, but what China is doing, what the Philippines is doing with China, what the Philippines is doing with Russia, that's a significant development. Even if it doesn't completely abandon the U.S., there is a strategic shift, and it's a significant shift away from the U.S.
Yeah, seems like a very sobering development there. It actually really demonstrates two of the main trends that the Trumpet has long been watching for, which are the decline of America's global power on one side and then the rise of the power of Russia and China on the other side. So it's definitely a significant development there. Thank you for sharing that with us, Anthony. Well, we mentioned earlier that many in Russia are eagerly awaiting January 20th when Mr. Trump takes up residency in the White House. Some influential Russians are saying his presidency will equate to a thaw in the U.S.-Russia relationship, and it'll be better not just for both nations, but for the whole world. But there's one Russian, actually a Russian dissident, the former world chess champion, Garry Kasparov, who says that if Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin were to form some kind of alliance, it would not be a blessing for the world at all. It would, in fact, be quite the opposite. Andrew, what can you tell us about this this sober warning from Mr. Kasparov?
Right. Well, definitely, Mr. Kasparov, these days he's been playing less chess and doing more political activism against the Putin administration. And he does have some serious concerns about just the amount of enthusiasm in Russia for the Trump administration, and then some of the comments Donald Trump has made about forming an alliance with Putin to fight the Islamic State, or about possibly recognizing Crimea as Russian territory. I think it was one of Trump's advisors who said that, actually, and maybe perhaps not Trump himself. And then also the idea of that unless NATO members keep paid up with their dues, we might not defend the Baltics from a Russian invasion if they haven't been contributing monetarily to NATO. That was another Trump campaign promise. There is definitely some concern there on Mr. Kasparov's part, where he's saying that there are a lot of people waiting for Trump. They believe Trump will change everything. They will give in to all Putin's demands, recognize annexation of Crimea, as well as undercutting NATO and sacrificing the Baltic states. Unless the United States is willing to restore the balance, we are entering a very dark age. And those comments were summarizing kind of some of the feelings that are in Russia. Like I said, he hasn't, Mr. Trump won't take office for another 2 weeks, so he actually hasn't done anything yet. It's possible some of his other he definitely has some very pro-Russian advisors, but he has a few anti-Russian advisors as well. So it will be interesting to see how the Trump administration tackles this issue. But Mr. Kasparov's definitely really at the forefront, warning that if he does do give into some of the indications that he might, and really start giving a free hand to Russia and Eastern Europe, that could be a very dark time for the peoples of Ukraine and the Baltics and some of these other post-Soviet states.
Do you think we will see that, a Trump-Putin alliance, or does that seem like Mr. Kasparov's concerns are ill-founded?
I think definitely it would be a very pragmatic alliance. I think the Trump administration is more concerned with reviving the American economy and focusing on America's domestic issues. He's said a lot about how we shouldn't be involved in nation building anymore, mm-hmm. and we need to work about our own infrastructure and some of these like America first isolationist tendencies toward. I think if he could negotiate a good deal with Putin, maybe some oil deals, drilling in the Arctic, that would bring jobs back to America, the welfare of the people of the Baltics and Crimea are probably not towards the forefront of his mind. But that's my opinion.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All these stories that we're talking about today are in that publication. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news items from around the world coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. One last brief look at some of the other big headlines from this week that caught our attention. First of all, we'll go to Brent.
The year 2016 was the deadliest in the history of suicide terrorism, an Israeli think tank said, with 469 suicide bombings carried out by 800 perpetrators in 28 countries, causing the deaths of about 5,650 people. The 469 attacks marks a small rise from 2015, yet in 2016, the number of fatalities rose up by about 1,000 to 5,650. The Islamic State was the leading perpetrator of suicide bombings worldwide, being directly or indirectly responsible for about 322 of those, or 70%.
Okay, and Richard.
Just under a week ago, it was New Year's Day You probably remember New Year's 2016 was famous for the massive sexual assaults within Germany. Didn't happen this year. And the main reason why, it seems, is racial profiling from the German police. They made sure to search people who looked like they were of North African origin, the same general type of people that carried out the attacks last year. And they got criticized by quite a few people. But what I think is interesting about this is just how much that's changed since last year. And even the left-wing leader of the Social Democratic Party was supporting the police in doing this. So that's quite a change from their political response 12 months, politically correct response 12 months ago.
Andrew.
Yeah, Chicago police arrested four men on charges of kidnapping a man, torturing him, and broadcasting the film on Facebook Live. It gained national attention because the four kidnappers were black, and the victim was a white handicapped man who they had forced to curse out Donald Trump and white people in general as they filmed this. The police are still looking into the possibility that this could have been done partially for ransom, but that it also looks like it may very well have been just a straight-out hate crime.
Okay, Anthony.
Tensions between Russia and the United States are surging toward Cold War levels. Various reports claim that Russian President Vladimir Putin is deploying missiles to the province of Kaliningrad, and this province borders Poland, Belarus, and Lithuania. Now, at the same time, as the New York Times reported, the U.S. and its NATO allies plan to send approximately 1,200 soldiers each to Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia.
All right, back to Brent.
An Israeli spy satellite has discovered a number of Russian mobile short-range ballistic missiles stockpiled in Syria, Channel 2 reported here in Israel today. The high-definition photos taken by the Israeli Eros-B satellite dubbed these weapons, or the weapons are dubbed as the Iskander missiles, and they're clearly seen on trucks just outside one of their army bases in western Syria. These missiles, they have a range of up to 500 kilometers. It's a medium-range ballistic weapon that has the capacity to carry nuclear warheads and superior to the old Scud missile model. The pictures seemingly prove what Western intelligence agencies have long suspected, that is that Russia has provided Syria with a wide array of the most advanced missiles in its possession.
And back to Andrew.
Gun sales in the United States hit a record high, with the FBI running 27.5 million background checks this year. That's double the number they ran just 8 years ago in 2009. They're attributing a lot of the spike in gun membership due to concerns that Hillary Clinton may have won the presidential election. And with some of her gun control policies, I think people were definitely trying to stock up before November 8th.
Anthony.
China confirmed this week that its aircraft carrier has for the first time conducted drills in the South China Sea with the formation of other warships and fighter jets. The Associated Press reported that this move could raise concern among China's neighbors.
And for the final story, we'll go to Richard once again.
Mein Kampf, Hitler's famous book, is entering its sixth print run after being published for the very first time since World War II in Germany just this year. Now, it sold 85,000 copies, which actually, to me, in a country of 80 million, is probably less than I would have initially expected. So it sounds like they're just printing ludicrously low amounts. But I think the most disturbing part of this story to me comes from Italy, where it really is receiving a surge in popularity. There was a newspaper in November last year that gave away free copies of Mein Kampf as a promotion. Last month, a survey by the Italian Ministry of Education found that Mein Kampf ranked in the top 10 books in 10 schools. So it seems like there, in some places in Europe at least, is a genuine popularity for this infamous book.
Well, thanks very much, Richard. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All of these stories that we've discussed are in this week's edition. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thank you to our panel, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadidwe, Brent Noctegal, and Richard Palmer.
Thanks for having me.
Great
to be here. Thank you.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Steve Herkus. And I'll leave you today with the words of the Irish poet William Butler Yeats. Education is not the filling of a pail, but rather the lighting of a fire. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a real pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.